welcome everybody to the funeral of celebration of John Mack, or John Mack, however you read it. Not bad for a man of 84 to have a chapel visible. There are still two seats down here if people would like to sit. You all happy to stand? My name is Stephen Holroyd, and I've been a close friend of John's since our 20s. In his last days, John asked Betty Morris, a former colleague and close friend, and me to organise his funeral. But don't imagine for one moment that we were given a free hand. There was an A4 page of instructions. The ceremony is to be humanist without an officiant. We were given multiple choices on readings, any 4 out of 6. Choose our own speakers, but Malcolm and Clive are to take part. And I quote, after the ceremony, please ensure that there's a well catered for party to which everyone at the occasion is invited. No expense is to be spared. Overprovide rather than underprovide. Champagne would be suitable. Be thankful that I didn't pursue the idea of speaking to you all on video, or asking you to form a conga around the crematorium. Now, we have quite a lot of speakers today, and there's no singing. But anyone who'd like to recount memories of John, there will be a microphone and speakers at the buffet lunch, so please feel free to use it then. If you'd like to make a donation to John's cause, the Samaritan's Harbour and District Lodge, you can pay via H.C. Patrick the Undertakers, as detailed in the service sheet, or there are collecting plates for next to the chapel. John worked for the Samaritans for about 20 years, often doing duties over Christmas when others wanted time off. So we start the first part. Please sit, but do make a call. You are standing here. I call this the end of term report. John was a man of letters, a very intelligent, wise, and caring person, with a great sense of humour, often naughty. For instance, during one of my many lectures on table manners to our children, he proceeded to demonstrate how to spit plum stones across a dining room table. He was close to his family and numerous cousins. He also kept in close touch with his many godchildren and never forgot a birthday and always gave thoughtful presents. John was an only child and grew up in Lewisham, Brighton. His father, Hugh, was a locomotive engine driver and often drove trains from East Winston to Aylesea along the original Blue Belt line. His mother Gladys had an excellent brain, which he passed on to her son. John sailed through his 11 plus and went to Brighton Grammar School. In his last days, and this is his last days on her day, he sang to Betty in his breathless voice a chorus from his old school song. And he's asked to play this to you now. It's been difficult to find because the school has no longer exist. But his old friend Malcolm and the help of his son, they provided a copy for Steve.
Goes to the eager, the laggard, oh.
Sway labori nihil, nothing without work. And from Bright Brown, he won a place at College Oxford. He contracted TB and was hospitalized for several months, and as a result, was excused national service. He was a stalwart supporter of Brighton and Philadelphia and attended matches whenever possible. In fact, Andrew, my wife and I took him to his last match on his 80th birthday at the Amex Chamber, which I think he much enjoyed. It was a bit slow getting out. He'd always wanted to teach, and after his diploma, got his first job teaching a school in Coventry. From there, he went to Oxford County School in Surrey as head of history. I think he was actually a teacher from Oxford here today, but we'll find out later. As head of history, and then in 1972, to Farnham College as vice principal. During this time, he was awarded a sabbatical to term at Churchill College, Cambridge. My brother James had met John at the Coventry School, and when John moved to Oxford in the mid-60s, he took lodgings with a barrister, Miss Bicknell, in Catron, which was in an adjacent bridge to my parents, with whom I was still living. James made the introduction, and although John was 8 years old, we became very close friends. Miss Bicknell had a Fijian husky, who was rather smitten with John, but news can make many passes, one of which was to carve four-letter words in his bath suit. I was told that even these bold approaches were firm. I have said how intelligent John was, but alas, he was totally amused by all things mechanical or electronic. His mastery of driving a car was a terrifying experience for a passenger. He bought himself a new Ford Anglia in the 60s, which after a few months had scarcely a panel left undamaged, as so was Miss Bicknell's gate places. Having moved to Farnham, John bought the house in Tor Road, which had the beautiful garden. John loved his garden and wildflowers, but believed in nature having its own way. It's difficult now to get to his front door without ducking around all the tall trucks and the apple tree, which is of gigantic proportions. It must be 30 feet high. John soon got involved in life in Parliament, and I suppose might have been an early member of the Coppice Society, for whom he was a related speaker on the walls. Then in 1991, John was struck down a heart attack, which made him take early retirement. John had always been fit and active. He was a very fast walker and had been a member of university darts and table tennis and bridge teams. With less stress, he would regularly travel to London to meet friends or go to the latest plays at the London National Theatre. He'd always travelled a lot, took hundreds of photos of his visits to India, China, South America, Australasia, and Europe, which our small children were dragooned into seeing with a long lecture. Now pay attention! He arrived at our wedding in 1968, having just escaped the clutches of the Russians after the overthrow of Alexander Dubček and Czechoslovakia. He did several tours with the National History Association in Europe and the UK. He joined the syndicate of racehorse owners with the Shaw family. And although Lady Luck wasn't often on his side, he loved parading the owner's ring with his jewelry flashes. Over the years, his heart condition worsened, and it's a miracle of modern medicine that John survived. He adapted his life to suit his heart. He's a keen member of U3A. When asked, undertook to research in depth the period of enlightenment, which he'd only studied briefly previously. I knew that this was stressful for him and a huge task, but I know the lecture. For a number of years, John was chairman of the Farnham Educational Foundation, the trustees of the buildings and land of the Sixth Form College. He was also a member of the Committee of Gay Scholarship Awards and bursaries to students of special endeavour services and achievements. With trips to London no longer possible, he really enjoyed the productions of the Maltings and the live streams of operas. So life continued for the moment. John was already for discussion on politics, and was a scarf exasperated that politicians had never studied history, not so many mistakes as it happened to be had. So, John, you had a very active and fulfilling life, giving a lot to others, and always being good company. Farewell, with all this you. Thoughts on Life and Death by Epicurus. I was not, I have been, I am not, I do not mind. Become accustomed to the belief that death is nothing to us, for all good and evil consists in sensation, but death is deprivation of sensation. And therefore, a right understanding of that death is nothing to us makes the mortality of life enjoyable. Not because it adds to it an infinite span of time, but because it takes away the craving for immortality. But there is nothing terrible in life for the man who has truly comprehended there is nothing terrible in not living.
The Peace of Death by John Swinburne. From too much of living, from hope and fear set free, we thank with brief thanksgiving whatever gods may be. But no life lives forever, that dead men rise up never, that even the weariest river winds somewhere safe to sea. Then star nor sun shall waken, nor any change of light, nor sound of waters shaken, nor any sound or sight, nor wintry leaves, nor vernal, nor days, nor things diurnal, only the sleep eternal in an eternal night.
Do not stand at my grave and weep, by Mary Elizabeth Fry. Do not stand at my grave and weep. I am not there, I do not sleep. I am a thousand winds that blow. I am the diamond glints on snow. I am the sunlight on ripened grain. I am the gentle autumn rain. When you awaken in the morning's hush, I am the swift uplifting rush of quiet birds in circled flight. I am the soft stars that shine at night. Do not stand at my grave and cry. I am not there. I did not die. Thank you.
Peter Wicks, Stephen Mander Holroyd, and Greg Edwards, who can't be here today. For all they did for John in the last few weeks, they were marvellous. And for organising the funeral. Thank you very much. As many friends commented, John was a lovely and caring man. I remember his thoughtfulness and the mischievous sense of humour that Stephen mentioned. When he stayed with us in Lewes, he would often take us to a small restaurant. Beforehand, my wife had told our children to be on their very best behaviour. She initially looked shocked, but then amused, when John began to lob meringues across. In our last telephone call, shortly before he died, I told him he was part of our family, and he was touched when he replied, "I know." Some happy recollections. For over 60 years, he was not only my oldest and closest friend, but the person with whom I talked things over when I needed advice or support, and I thank him for his wise advice over the years. His concern for others is reflected in numerous ways. The many friendships that bring you here today, his work with the Samaritans, and his support for many charities. As Stephen mentioned, I got to know him when we were at school together in the 1950s, and we sang the school song at the end of each term. We shared an inspirational history teacher who motivated us to study history at university. I came across him when he first showed his talents as an administrator, probably running the school bookroom where we bought our books and acting as quartermaster in the combined cadet force store. Before he left to study history at Hartford, sorry, before me he left to study history at Hartford, and I went on to begin my national service. 2 years later, our lives unexpectedly crossed again. John received a clean bill of health from the TB that Stephen mentioned, and we found ourselves once again as new boys in our old school, but this time as members of staff. At the end of term, one of his classes gave him a pair of purple socks, which he wore for many years, and I'm glad to say, oh, no. John's on that. I'm wearing a pair of purple socks. We became and remained close friends and got to know most of the bunch in Britain. He was best man at my wedding, where he made a hilarious speech. He often stayed with us, and my son Richard was one of his many godchildren. And he really came with Richard's birthday and joined us in the summer when he wasn't watching one of his horses run. He told me his proudest moment was when he led one of the syndicate's rare winners into the winner's enclosure in Goodwood. We had family fun Christmases. My son and I remember him energetically attacking soap bubbles with a pair of scissors. After my first wife died, he continued to spend Christmas with us for several years. And before we went to bed, after a convivial evening together, we would creep upstairs to leave stockings for my children outside their room. Years later, they told us they were wide awake, giggling at the noise of the wind, while we believed we were silent eating. As Stephen said, he was a keen traveller, and after visiting Italy on a six-month trip, and he travelled alone. On one occasion, this is the 1970s, was sitting on a beach in a holiday resort in Israel, opening a bottle of beer. It suddenly exploded. Everyone hurled themselves to the ground. John wasn't hurt, which was fortunate, because he's opening the bottle between his knees. Another time, he was on a visit to the Somme battlefield. He had great difficulty in keeping a straight face when an old soldier in a wheelchair nearly tumbled into a trench. I'll pass over an unfortunate element of right he made in India. A An educational tour to China gave him a chance to see a country that he wanted to see. And he was rather pleased with the inefficient Chinese bureaucracy meant the cancellation of visits to school, they rather dull visits. And he told me he was even more delighted when he got home to receive a substantial refund and an apology. After he left Farnham College, as he often said to me, feet first on a stretcher. His first visit abroad was to my house in France, where we spent many happy holidays together until he began to find travelling abroad difficult. Stephen mentioned his funeral notes and the comment about the Congo. I'm glad, however, that he didn't renew the request he made to me soon after his first heart attack. He asked me, will I mind hiding behind the curtains in the crematorium? And as his coffee was trundled out, he pulled the curtains back, waved and waved. Goodbye, folks! Thank you for a long and happy adventure.
I have to say, hearing Malcolm talk about that, one of the funny things John told me was about when they went to Lourdes, he was with other students, and they commandeered, did you know about this, John? They commandeered in a bath chair from outside of the chapel, wheeled him down into the grotto area, whereupon he leapt up to the as he was at Father Boys Grammar School and at the college. It is a tribute. Say, I first met John 47 years ago, in January 1972, when he arrived at Father Boys Grammar School as deputy headmaster. I had the privilege and pleasure of working with him for the next 26 years. After the initial, I must say, rather intimidating impact of this enormous black-bearded giant, I soon found him to be the most warm and most engaging of men. My perception, obviously, foreshadowed that of almost everybody who met him subsequently, colleagues and students alike. I don't know what he would have meant of it, but the commonest reply to my request for memories of John was, he was a lovely man. But another, particularly from past students, not to be trifled with. John certainly impressed the boys at the grammar school, who of course knew him for several years. To paraphrase one of them, Michael Metta, John was deputy headmaster, and quite unlike any other member of staff at the school, tall and bearded, he would be seen in a billowing gown, striding along the corridors, dealing with trouble spots, which he had an uncanny ability to anticipate. Mr. McLaughlin was very much a figure of authority and not to be trifled with. Indeed, it was not until I was 50 years old that I had the courage to stop addressing him as Sir. Another old boy, and sad to say, the late comedian Jeremy Hardy, wrote some years ago in a piece he did, I think, for Blunderbuss. When I arrived as an 11-year-old, Mr. McLaughlin, I still find it hard to think of him as John, was a terrifying figure, a towering disciplinarian, not to be trifled with. Over the years, though, I began to suspect that he was actually winding us up. And that was what John was so good at, exercising control but with a twinkle in his eye. His skill was very much needed too when the two grad schools were combined to form the sixth form college. It was a very exciting time, but the process of blending three staffs together, the girls' school, the boys' school, and they were very different animals, and about 20 newcomers was no simple task, and it fell mainly onto John's shoulders. He must have heard so many moans and groans in his little cupboard of an office, as such a disparate group of people tried to settle down to work together. It was a good thing that he was such a sensitive and responsive manager, acute in his observations and scrupulous in his judgment. He was really the oil in the machine. On a more mysterious note, I think you could probably also say that he was the Sir Humphrey of Farnham College. Kathleen confided to me and how John supported her when she arrived as new principal of the college. And she spoke of his diplomacy, his caring, his values, and his intellect. She described him as a superb teacher who challenged and supported his students and demanded the highest of standards. And then a few quotes from other colleagues. Though John looked scary, he could actually be the kindest, most considerate person if you went to him with a problem. He also had a wicked sense of humour, with a deadpan expression, but with a twinkle in his eye, he could hardly believe in anything. Somebody else said he was nicknamed the Ayatollah in the aftermath of the Iranian Revolution. But he wasn't in any way fierce enough to carry it on. Too much of a twinkle in his eye. Somebody else said he was a man of great integrity and very knowledgeable in a wide range of subjects. He was a private person and a true gentleman. All those who knew him at Farnham College, students and staff alike, respected him enormously, and he will truly be missed by us all. On a personal note, I've been very lucky and privileged to have spent a lot of time with John Mack, as I always called him, over the last few years. My family's not had the best of times, and John was a huge comfort to me. He was a most wonderful lunch companion, chatting about everything from politics to football, always with tremendous knowledge and intellect, and always with that delicious dry wit. Finally, I was very interested in John's choice of reading, particularly the piece from Epicurus, which I would have hated to have read. Thank you, Clive. Now, Epicurus, I have no idea of being an ignorant biology teacher. For those of you who, like me, thought Epicureans were merely people who liked fine food and wine, Epicurus was actually a Greek philosopher who was notable for all sorts of things, but notably for contemplating on how to live a happy and tranquil life. And to bring it down to basics, he advocated three things: living simply, learning, and above all, cultivating friendship. John Mack lived simply. Did any of you see his house? He read and learned voraciously. You couldn't see his wallpaper for books. And above all, he loved and valued his friends. I think he would have loved to be remembered as a true Epicurean.
If I should go before the rest of you, by Joyce Grenfell. If I should go before the rest of you, break not a flower, nor inscribe a stone, nor, when I am gone, speak in a Sunday voice, but be the usual selves that I have known. Weep if you must, parting is hell, but life goes on, so sing as well.
Thou is the light for the world, thou is the light. Thank you.